I've often felt he had a Napoleon complex, you know, about his height. Because he jokes about it nonstop.
Oh yeah.
If you have to know which strings to pull, but if you pull the wrong string, you can see a different side of Gilligan. He can change immediately
Right.
going. Well, you'll be the first person I'll tell this to. He rang me the other day and he was talking to me and he says, "Jason, tell me honestly, do you think I'm a psychopath?"
Jason, thanks very much for sitting down with me. I appreciate it a lot. Can you do us a favor there? Can you tell us how a journalist ends up having these intense, like 35 in total 35-hour interviews with John Gilligan, resulting in a documentary and a book? How did the seed of this get planted originally?
Well, I'll just correct one thing there. So I know it says 35 hours in the book, but it ended up going to over 40 hours in the end. So we got more time with him. But the how it happened is it's a bit of a long story, but I'll try to condense it for you, John. In 2008, I was working for Hot Press magazine, and I went over to Rome to meet Giovanni Di Stefano, aka the Devil's Advocate, who at the time was representing Milosevic and Chemical Ali and Saddam Hussein and Paddy Holland and John Gilligan. And the interview ran across 5 or 6 pages in the magazine. And he was really impressed with it. He really liked how I'd written it as a Q&A format, incidentally, like the book, the Gilligan tapes. And I said to him, "Any chance when I was leaving his apartment in Rome, is there any chance you get an interview with me, with Gilligan?" And he said, "Leave it with me." And a couple of months later, he rang me saying that he was in Baghdad. For all I know, now that I'm sure you know, Giovanni spent 10 years in prison for fraud, and the English court said he was not a qualified solicitor. But so for all I know, he could have been in his apartment, you know, crinkling paper, pretending that he was abroad somewhere in a war zone. But he said, "Yeah, you're on the guest list, so to speak. Gilligan will see you next week in Portlaoise prison."
Go
So I went down to Portlaoise prison. I met with Gilligan. After two and a half hours with him, I ran out of the prison to the nearest bar and made copious notes.
on.
But that later, because you couldn't bring a recorder in and nobody knew I was a journalist, I just signed in as a visitor. But later that week, Gilligan started calling me at late at night. So we recorded 4 or 5 hours of interviews for the article, and we ran it as in Hot Press as 13,000 words. It caused quite a controversy at the time. The Minister for Justice, the then Minister for Justice, Dermot Ahern, demanded an investigation into how I got into the prison. And Hot Press itself was subsequently banned from the prison system. So, I
Was the uproar was the fact that you'd kind of that you'd like done an interview without them knowing, or the fact that that someone was kind of giving Gilligan a voice?
it was both.
Hmm.
And so, but out of that, it snowballed. Other criminals started coming to me. I interviewed a couple of weeks later Dutchie Holland in London in a prison. Fat Puss rang me. I interviewed Christy Dunne. There was all these characters, over a dozen of them, and it ended up being a book called Crime Inc. I had enough of them to fill a 400-page book called Crime Inc. And then I stopped writing about crime because I went off to work for the Daily Mail. My late mentor and editor Paul Drury, who I dedicated this book to, the Gilligan tapes, he told me, "You know, get out of crime now. Now is your time to progress onto more serious subjects," as he put it, you know, but less tabloidy, I suppose he meant.
Right.
But then in 2013, Gilligan rang me on his release from prison and asked to meet me, and I met him in Jessbrook. And I met him in some other secret locations. He turned up in disguise because there was a hit out on him at the time. So we had all these meetings, and I recorded them, and we had discussions about doing a book. We even met in London at the Reform Club, and the idea evaporated after a few meetings because he wouldn't go into he wouldn't admit to being a drug dealer, to having this drug empire, because he was still battling CAB, who were trying to seize the equestrian center in Jessbrook. And he knew that if he was to admit to his drug empire, he'd lose everything. But he did lose everything anyway. So then in 2000, I didn't hear from him for 9 years, and I didn't think I'd ever hear from him again, to be quite frank with you. But then in 2022, April 2022, Gilligan left a voice message at the Hot Press office, and they emailed me with his number. And I just woke up one Monday morning in April and seen this message, and I went, my heart races going, what the hell is this guy looking for me for?
Right.
Yeah. So I immediately went out and bought a burner phone because I didn't want Gilligan having my number. And I rang him, and I knew what he wanted. I kind of knew what he wanted when I was just before I rang him. I kind of said, oh, it must be about a book. And he said, do you want to do a book? And I said to him, I'll have to think about it. So he said, come back to me in a week. So I came back to him in a week, and I said, yeah, I'll do it. But it's my book. It's not your book. I'm not going to be your mouthpiece.
Right.
And I'll do the book like the Hot Press interviews. The famous Hot Press interviews where they're Q&A.
Right.
And I had done the Q&A Hot Press interviews for 6 years. So it was a style I was very comfortable with. And I knew it worked best with this book. But then I said to him, why don't we record the interviews on for potentially a documentary too? And he was hesitant. So then it was his turn to go away and think about it. So that took another few days. And then he said, okay, go out and buy the equipment. I won't let you down. So I went out and bought two 4K cameras, figured out how to use them, and I'm in Madrid, so I took a train down to Torrevieja, to Alicante, and then a bus to Torrevieja, where he lives on the Costa Blanca coastline. It's kind of a dreary, seedy seaside town on that part of the coast, full of drugs, full of crime. So Gilligan fits in very well. And we met in the hotel I had booked, and I had all the cameras set up in the room. And when he went up to the room, he was very impressed, because I had two cameras, and all the equipment was there. And he said, I wish I was younger. I could have stole all this stuff for you, he said.
Probably.
Yeah. So that week we met 4 or 5 days, and we do maybe 2.5 hours, sometimes 3 hours of interviews. And the first day was a disaster for me because I had positioned I as you know I was a novice, and I had to learn on the go. I had put him against the window, which is a big no-no, because when I put him against the window, he end up looking like one of these silhouettes you see in a crime show where they're trying to disguise the face.
Right.
So the second day, I had to redo most of the questions, and we just took it from there. So after about 4 or 5, after 5 days, I headed back to home and started working on the tapes, listening to them, figuring out what I needed. Then I went back a month later, then another 2 months later, and each time, then I went about 6 times in total, maybe 7, to see him. And each time, I would, transcribe the tapes, listen to them, see what I was missing, and then go back to them the next time. So you respect, you're doing two or three hours a day, and then we'd go and have coffee or breakfast, and because we meet very early in the mornings, and he would start regaling me with stories off the record. So I've enough material when he shuffles off this mortal coil to write another book on him.
That's funny. Very good. Jesus. Christ, and 35 hours of the sit down interviews, and then more time over the phone. Given all that fairly intense time with him and the fact that you've met a couple of times sporadically over the decades, do you feel after all this that you have like a good sense for him, that you know the man?
Yeah, I really feel that I know what makes him tick at this stage, but he is still a complicated character, and sometimes you're still learning new things about him. I mean, just before I came on this show, he rang me to complain about Liveline and Joe Duffy, so he can take it unexpected sometimes with some of his comments, and he's actually one of these characters that jokes all the time.
Yeah,
Is it
I
about?
know I definitely know it's a sense of humor in the book a lot, yeah.
Yeah. So what did you make of the book?
I loved it. I just actually on that note, about all these jokes he'd be cracking, I wanted to ask you if it seemed okay. So one example I'm thinking of is when there was a very close attempt on his life, not when he actually got shot, but in 2013 when he narrowly avoided being in a place where he was supposedly gonna get shot. I think he said to you over the phone, "Oh, I'll meet you." He was supposed to be shot at a place called the Halfway House, and he said, "Oh, I'll meet you around there for an interview, just not the Halfway House." And there's other little things like that he'll kind of make light of, like of a grave situation. Did you get a sense that that was genuine or a front, kind of just bravado to say that he's not worried?
Oh, with the attempt on his life, it was definitely a front. I believe he does say in the book that he was rattled about that, which surprised me, the honesty. What has surprised me about the book, the interviews, is he takes you he surprises you with the honesty sometimes. When I, like, for example, when I asked him, did he ever hit his wife, his ex-wife, and he just came straight out with the answer yes. But then he tried to make a joke of it. And I told him we can't be joking about domestic violence, and he apologized.
Right. Yeah, I recall that one too. Another one I wanted to ask you if it seemed genuine, but he's constantly making kind of self-deprecating jokes about his height. He even joked that like Danny DeVito should play him in a film sometime. I wanted to ask you again, did it seem genuine or was it like a kind of an attempt at like fake vulnerability in order to seem more relatable to and that sort of thing?
Yeah, well, I've often felt he had a Napoleon complex, about his height, because he jokes about it nonstop. Even in the previous conversation, just before we were doing this podcast, he was joking about his height. So it's something he constantly jokes about, and sometimes I get the feeling that he's just making light of it. He's himself, but sometimes I do feel he has a complex about it.
Interesting. He did there was a couple of times he played down any claims that other people made of him of being like a hard man, being like, yeah, he was obviously involved in the drug trade and deep in the underworld, but not one of these like kind of terrifying, violent, kind of hard men. He always kind of says that he wasn't.
Yeah, well, I don't believe he was as violent as, say, the general who nailed the guy to the floor, one famous incident. But obviously Gilligan was feared, and that fear had to come from somewhere.
Yeah, of
But
course.
he does portray himself as an ordinary decent criminal, but obviously he's putting his best foot forward here. He isn't an intelligent, sometimes even charming, and clearly a very resourceful individual. But John, everything is about the bottom line. He's, money. He's not some sort of working class hero. He is not a helpless victim of fate or society. This is not a sob story. He had plenty of opportunities to walk away from his life of crime. Gilligan, by his own, self-confession here, he chose to be a criminal. He chose to act in that manner. So I suppose the book is really, a portrait of crime and of a master criminal who really sowed the dragon's teeth of the Kinahans.
I actually, speaking of okay, so seeing as he's been around so many decades, he's come across and interacted with like some of the biggest names if you follow like kind of Irish crime. Obviously you mentioned Martin Cahill. He worked closely with him. I don't know if he was actually in his gang, but he did, like, at one stage he even claimed that he was paying Martin Cahill like a wage. He was helping him out, like, financially.
Yeah, that has taken everybody aback. In the, it was even a front page story in the Star and the Mirror a couple of days ago. That particular excerpt. I was really taken aback by it. That he said, the general was flat broke, because he might have been a successful criminal in the sense of masterminding these great strokes, but he was never making much money from it. So he ended up giving him £500 a week, he told me. I also heard that when he died, I don't know if this is true, John Traynor, his right hand man, ended up paying for his funeral.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, he did. From the I mean, I did read Martin Cowell's book. From the little I know, he didn't seem to be, like one of these kind of financial planner types who would, like, use his, you hear about Jerry Hutch using money from robberies to, like, buy property and stuff, to think, real forward thinking stuff. I think Martin Cahill was more, can do a job and get a bit of money from it and use that.
Yeah, well, Gilligan told me that Cattle a lot of the time did robberies just to annoy the guards. So he was doing it for a bit of fun, a bit of crack, as you'd say in Ireland. But Gilligan does make the point that when when the general robbed the paintings, he had no success with them, even though it was a huge international story.
Right.
Then when he did the O'Connell's Jewellers, Gilligan said they only got something like £26,000 each after spending a whole year planning that operation.
Jesus
So
Christ.
if Gilligan was making one heist, Gilligan did was for £1 million of VHS machines. Then you have going in and robbing several million from the banks, the heist that he did. So the Hutch and Gilligan were rolling in money, where it seems to be that cattle wasn't.
Interesting. You said there that the Martin Cahill, his relationship with the cops was, that there was, you said there was times he would do things like purely just to get one over on him to annoy him. Gilligan, I noticed Gilligan has a very kind of, you could call it like an us and them relationship with the cops. He very much draws a line between, like, between criminals and cops. He says you're either a criminal or you're not. And he said, like, even criminals he wouldn't get along with, he'd wish him the best, like, against the guards. He has this kind of honor among thieves attitude. Again, did you see that as being genuine, or he just wanted to seem like someone who's principled?
No, that is genuine. He's, for example, he said, I hope the person that killed Martin Cattle is never arrested, is never charged. I hope he gets away with it, despite the fact that he was on good terms with Cattle. And he was genuine when he said that. And he also said he hoped the person that shot him 6 times is never arrested. And he tried to throw me off the scent when he claimed in the book, which was a ridiculous claim, that two black men had tried to assassinate him at the time in Luke. How would he know there were black men? Wouldn't they have, they wouldn't just they would disguise themselves, wouldn't they, going in on a hit like that?
Right, yeah, unless they didn't wear gloves or something.
Yeah, and he says that's one of his biggest regrets in his life, when he got arrested for not wearing gloves.
Oh yeah, he did say that. Yeah, he has, to be fair now, like, yeah, I don't know how genuine it is, but he does have a sense of humor about, about kind of looking back on his life of crime. He does view it with, he does kind of see, like, the comedy in it at times.
Yeah, and
Sorry, going on.
comedy, like, for example, if you remember the VHS machine story, he purposely went out and bought, there were not over £900, these VHS machines. And when he did that heist of the £1 million worth of VHS machines, he purposely went out and purchased one on Grafton Street and put the receipt underneath it. So when the guards came into his house and they saw the machine, they rubbed their hands together in glee and said, we've got you red-handed. And he said, look underneath the machine. And when they see him, the receipt there, you know, Gilligan roared laughing at them.
I remember, yeah, not to just keep talking about the funny stories that this former drug lord told,
Yeah.
but one of them, he was in, I think it was in Port Leash, he was definitely in prison, and he had like a lady friend who was visiting him, and it was just him and her in the visiting room, and a cop who's supposed to keep them apart and stuff. And he said he went under the table and started giving her like oral sex. And then the guard looks over him and says, "What are you doing?" And he sticks his head up and says, "I'm doing 22 years," and just went back.
Yeah, I think that's one of the funnier stories in the book, and you're actually the first person to have been brave enough to mention it. Nobody else has touched that particular story.
That's funny. I was on the train. I was on the train. I burst out laughing when I saw it, actually, when I was reading it. It was very funny. Again, though, like, did he come across for someone who cracks so many jokes and does come across as charming, probably if you didn't know him, did it feel like you were sitting there with what, like, whatever, like, an underworld figure is kind of supposed to feel like in terms of just sharing room with him? I've heard that like a lot of them can come across very intense, like the air almost changes with them, like.
Oh yeah, if you have to know which strings to pull, but if you pull the wrong string, you can see a different side of Gilligan. He can change immediately, going from a jovial laughing character to very serious, frustrating, even angry. I think I say it in the book. If you bring up Cab, you bring up certain journalists, you bring up his old partners in crime like John Traynor. Or Brian Meehan, he goes ballistic. He goes ballistic when you mentioned the alleged phone call he was meant to have made to Veronica Guerin and threatening to sodomize her young child.
Correct. Yeah. Yeah.
That he goes crazy with that, and he constantly brings that story up to me. That you know, he constantly claims that he never made that phone call, and he's always saying that. In his court case, the murder case, where he was found not guilty of murdering Veronica, he said that he would have been found, he believes he would have been found guilty if they could have proved that phone call was made. And in the courts, his legal team had demanded her phone records and his phone records, etc., had you know were produced and analyzed. And he said that he said that they couldn't find the call on her you know call sheet. So he keeps going on about that, making that point that he claims that he would still be in prison today, and would have you know been found guilty of murder if they could have proved the call. Now the court case itself was a bit before my time. I was only really a young up-and-coming reporter at the time, so it's not a story. I didn't really pay that much attention to the court case because I actually wasn't much in the country at the time.
Oh, North. I did want to ask you, because Cahill, one of the more prolific assassinations in Irish criminal history, what was Martin Cahill. It's I think it's sort of accepted that it was the IRA, and as a result of not paying like a tax to them for a robbery, and also the fact that they tried selling these famous paintings to a loyalist gang, which of course is a direct enemy of the IRA, and you're helping them out. Did he address any? I know there's rumors that Gilligan was somehow involved. Did he address them at all?
Yes, and also another reason why the IRA killed Martin Cahill was because he helped them, the loyalists, to organise the bombing, the failed bombing of the Widow Scanlan's pub, where they killed the I think his name was Martin Doherty, the doorman at the Widow Scanlan's pub.
This one on Pier Street, was it?
Yeah, he gave them the car, the getaway car, apparently.
Really?
Yeah, so I know a high up ranking guy in the IRA, and he told me, yeah, we definitely did it. So it's hard to see how Gilligan could have been involved in that murder. I know there's theories out there, especially in the tabloids, that Martin Cattell had lent Gilligan money to start up, you know, the so-called seed money to start up his drug empire. But it's hard to see how Cattell would have had 200 or 300 grand at that time if Gilligan was giving him 500 euro a week.
Right, yeah, the two couldn't be true, probably.
Yeah.
There's a lot of he recounts very candidly, like, a lot of interactions with guards that like a guard couldn't, like, officially say, like, a guard would get into trouble. Like, the one I'm thinking of is when he used to, like, do armed robberies, banks and post offices, and he said that a guard told him that if we see you coming out of a job, even if you're not pointing the gun at, like, even if you're not threatening us or pointing the gun, but we'll blow you away, like, just because you're doing so many, and that's what he said stopped him, you know.
Yeah, I'd say he genuinely feared for his life at that stage, robbing banks, because a few criminals had been shot dead by the guards. As Michael, the former assistant Garda commissioner says, Michael O'Sullivan says in the documentary in episode one, you know, he doubts a guard would have said anything like that to Gilligan. But I honestly believe that Gilligan really feared he would have been shot. It's another thing if the guard said it to him or not.
Right, yeah, I see. His story, much like many criminals, is he starts off very poor. He builds up money and reaches, like, a peak of, I don't know, like, the Scarface-esque type of lifestyle, like, rolling in money, kind of. He's able to buy, like, his own equestrian center and kind of do whatever he wants, and then back again to being poor. It's like rags to riches to rags. Can you give us a bit of an idea, like when he was at his peak money wise, like, how many years, like, was this, like, just like multimillionaire peak, and like what years were they?
No, it was only about 2.5 years or 3 years. You're talking from 94 to 96. 94, he was released from Portlaoise prison after serving 4 years for a ridiculous charge of robbing 3,600 and odd pounds worth of material from some kind of DIY factory or something like that. You know, he was going out and robbing the material to build the equestrian center. And he just hide it in prison. Well, this is ridiculous. I'm not going to get done again for this type of robbery. So he said when he get out of prison, he decided to start smuggling cigarettes, and he was very successful at that. And then him and Trainer decided to start smuggling marijuana into the country, and he said at one stage he was making $500,000 a week. So he told me he made at least 12 million euro from that enterprise. He gambled 20 million.
Christ above. I'll ask you a bit more about his gambling later on, because that's another interesting subject. But during his peak, I was looking out for in the book. I don't think he mentioned it, but was there any did he mention any, like, attempts on his life when he was like at the top of the heap, so to speak? There was obviously some later on, but ironically, it was when he was no longer kind of king of the hill, you know.
Yeah, no, there was no attempts in his life that I know of during that period. He never mentioned any. And, you know, he probably would have mentioned it to me if there had been. But he spent the majority of that time over in Holland. So he really wasn't in Dublin that much, flexing his muscles. He had Brian Meehan to run the show for him in Dublin.
Right.
And he claims that the gang grew, this Gilligan gang grew because of Brian Meehan getting lazy and deciding to hire acquaintances or friends to do the jobs he should have been doing. So Gilligan said he'd come home to Ireland and find extra people in the gang that he hadn't got a clue who they were, you know.
Right, I see.
And
Yeah, go on.
he started giving out to Brian Meehan over that, he told me.
Interesting. He seems to have avoided any feuds during that time. I mean, they weren't mentioned at least. I mean, you know, I mean, more recently, as you hear about the Hutch Kinahan feud, that's probably like a bit of an exception. But you know, these drug gangs do often battle over turf and so on.
Well, Brian Mayne had at that time attempted to kill Martin Foley twice at close
Oh yeah,
range.
the Viper, yeah.
Yep, shot him at on two different occasions. Shot at him at close range and missed him completely. Apparently, I read a submachine gun. That sounds crazy.
Yeah.
And so twice he tried to kill Martin Foley. So that I've been told that's the reason why Brian Mean wasn't the trigger man in the murder of Fronica Geerin, because he wasn't trusted anymore to kill anybody.
Interesting. So it's accepted that that Patrick Dutchy Holland was the one who pulled the trigger.
No. Gilligan says that Charlie Bowden pulled the trigger.
Sorry.
Yeah,
Just
that's in the book. I was
the
surprised that got legaled. I was expecting that line to be taken out, but that's in the book and it's in the documentary. It's in episode 3. It's an electrifying moment on camera where I tell Gilligan, look at that camera and pretend it's Charlie Bowden. What would you say to him? And he goes on a very passionate rant, you know.
Do you think he's being fully upfront about who killed who personally killed Geerin? I mean, he denies that he ordered it or had anything to do with it. But do you think there would be some motive for him to not be honest about the actual trigger man?
There could be a hidden agenda there, but it makes sense to me that it was Charlie Bowden, because Charlie Bowden was in the Irish Army and was won a lot of marksman competitions. So he was apparently a fabulous aim, and also he was a gun fanatic. He was the one with Bowden that was buying all these guns that they were hiding in a Jewish cemetery, and it was him. Gilligan says that demanded that a Magnum be used in this assassination. And at one stage, Trainer, Gilligan claims, had offered Bowden money to assassinate Geerin from afar as a sniper on top of a building. That was their original plan.
It's funny now, like he does admit to a lot of obviously illegal activities and just like immoral activities, but I think he's careful. Like I don't think he ever admitted to importing any drug that was like worse than like cannabis or hash. And I don't think he really alluded to anyone that he might have had killed. I think he spoke about it like in hypotheticals, like, oh, if I knew someone were coming for me, I'd make sure to get them first. But it was always framed as like an if, you know.
It was.
Did you get the sense he was just kind of admitting to like enough that we all know, but not really into into like the heroin dealing or the murder and stuff?
Well, Gilligan never dealt in heroin.
That's a fact, yeah.
Definitely not. I can tell he might have done it later if he had still stayed around, but it was Trainer that was dealing in heroin. Trainer was the one that had the brothels, and Gilligan says in the book he was always against brothels. But at that time, it was only 2.5 years into the business. The guy that was his go-to guy in Amsterdam was getting him was getting him cannabis to get into the country, and he was still smuggling cigarettes, and he was also money laundering in Amsterdam for other criminals. He had a like a bureau de change for them. He would tell them what the going rate for the day is, and you know, change 1 million or 2 million guilders for criminals that couldn't walk into a bank. So if there was Irish guys going over to Amsterdam with a couple of hundred grand in their pocket to buy drugs, they'd obviously need guilders. So he was changing the money for them, and he said he was making a fortune out of that too. So no, I get nobody's ever accused Gilligan of dealing with heroin.
Yeah.
With regards the murder itself, I mean, there's no double jeopardy. He could admit to it if he wanted to. He could say he ordered a hit and he can't be arrested again for it because he was already found not guilty of the murder in the Special Criminal Court. He claims that the gang went rogue on him and that they did it behind his back. He had obviously a motive himself for the alleged assault of Veronica. He was looking at, a court, an impending court case for that. But John Traynor equally had a very good motive because he had taken out an injunction against Sunday Independent that week because Veronica had written up a story accusing him of being a heroin dealer, which he was. It's also been alleged Traynor assaulted her as well.
As in it was Trainer who assaulted her when she came to Jessbrook or
No,
different.
on a different occasion as well that he assaulted her too. So, and look, Gilligan claims he never assaulted Veronica in the book, but there is a picture of Veronica with a black eye, and that old cliched expression, a picture tells a thousand words. Well, that picture obviously tells a million words. But Gilligan denies he had any involvement in the murder. He said he didn't know about the murder.
Oh yeah, okay. Another claim that he made about Gearan was okay. So she was shot in the leg in her home, not too long before she was assassinated. I'm not quite sure how long, but she someone broke into her house and shot her in the leg. It was probably most probably a warning because they could have killed her if they wanted. He claimed, I think that he that she did it herself.
Yeah, and he's not the first person to claim that. That was a rumor going around at the time. Emily O'Reilly wrote about that in her controversial book shortly after Veronica's death. Gilligan tells me that she tried to buy a gun off Traynor at one stage. It all sounds very far-fetched to me. Why would a journalist want to shoot themselves in the leg? But Gilligan claims that she wanted to increase her profile. I wouldn't shoot myself in the leg if I wanted to increase my profile. I'll tell
You're
you
not
that.
that power hungry now, Jesus.
Yeah.
Time.
Sounds it just sounds bizarre, but it's not he's not the first person to make that accusation, and it has been printed in Emily O'Reilly's book too. But the guards just in her book I think dismissed it,
I see. Like I said, he went from being born into what you could call like maybe not extreme poverty, but serious poverty. Reached the peak of being like the big Don, and then you said that the sense you got from him, and he said it many times, was that nowadays he's broke, that he hadn't got a penny. Again, did this strike you as being true? Or I mean, I can imagine if he still has money tucked away, it would be in his interest to convince people that he doesn't. But did you?
It would be in his interest to tell people he's broke, but I've seen how he lives. I've seen the clothes he wears. There's no flash clothes anymore, as I say in the book. He's still wearing the same suit the day, from the day he got out of prison, and it looks about a dozen seasons out of style. A broken button on the suit that in a half moon shape. He's definitely putting on the poor mouth, intentionally or unintentionally, I don't know. But he has occasionally said to me, "I've only got X amount of money this month," and I know he bets heavy on the Premiership football. And recently, that he's been telling me that's how he's surviving. For example, he puts several hundred on a double, say Liverpool to win and City to win, two certain matches, So he's been doing a lot of them, and he always shows me. He makes a point of always sending me the betting slips on WhatsApp or whatever,
That's funny. Yeah, that's been one theme through his life. In fact, to be honest, it almost seems a bit predestined because he tells about his father being a hell of a gambler, and even Gilligan or John himself when he was a boy being sent down to the bookies to place bets for his father, and then he would, you know, it would he would become aware of this thing called gambling, and you can win money. He's talked about some of the figures that he's gambled over the years. Can you go into them a little bit? Some of them, if they're to be believed, are shocking, like.
Oh, and I would believe the amount of money he has gambled, because I've seen him gamble crazy amounts of money when we were doing the documentary and the book. You know, during breaks, the first thing he would do is pick up his phone and check his the latest horse races or whatever to see how much he'd won or lost, or the football matches. So he claims he spent 20 million. He lost 20 million of his money through gambling, and sounds like a phenomenal figure, but it could be true in with him, because he was betting when at the height of his powers. He was betting every day in Amsterdam in the casinos, like a drunken sailor. And I think one of there's some stories in the book where he went when he was a merchant navy on working on the merchant navy, on the boats. He when he'd come back from sea after a month or two, and you get your wages, on two occasions, consecutive occasions, he was in Liverpool, and he spent his wages, lost his wages in one night gambling, and ended up sleeping on a bench in Liverpool, and had to go back on the boats again, to make more money. And then when he came back, he lost that money again, sleeping on the benches again. And then he took up with a Liverpool gang, which nobody ever knew about. This is the first time anybody's heard about it. It's in the book. And he started robbing jewelries with them, jewelers with them. And then he ended up taking their bag of loot one stage and running off to back to the boats, the B&I boats, to meet his father and brother, and they sold it for him. So I believe those stories where he'd be foolish enough to spend his wages, you know, his entire wages on a couple of horses, and have lost the whole lot, lost his shirt.
Let's see. This I maybe it's a small bit obvious, but I think there's a difference between someone who gambles a lot, who looks at it as a way of like trying to make money, and someone who's like a gambling addict whose body actually craves the chemicals that your brain produces when you're gambling, you know, the adrenaline and serotonin, sort of dopamine. Did he strike you as someone who was like that second type of like a proper gambling addict, or someone who just kind of looked at it as a like a way of making money?
I think he's a gambling addict, but at the moment he's forced himself to look at it as a way of making money. In the past, Gilligan would get drunk and just spend it all. You know, he'd put just say he made 800 or 1,000 or 2,000 a day. He could have got drunk in the past and put that 2,000 on one horse or two horses and lost it all. That's the type of character he is. So I know now for a fact that he won't touch a drop of drink while he's gambling, because he doesn't want to get too adventurous. He's keeping to his system.
I remember him saying he'll keep his phone away from himself if he's drinking, yeah, because he'd only go online onto the app and start betting, like.
And you know,
On the subject of vices, I think gambling is pretty much the only vice that he sort of admitted to. Was there any that you thought he may have been hiding, possibly, or was it just the old gambling?
no, it's just a gambling and obviously young women. On one occasion, he had a younger lover, Carol Rooney, and they had a big romance. So, apart from that, I mean, I think he loved being numero uno. Obviously has a big ego. You'd have to have a big ego if you're that type, if you're a criminal like that, a successful criminal, or slash fa successful slash you know failed criminal at this stage, because he is a busted flush. But no, I can't think of any other vices. He doesn't do drugs. He doesn't like drugs. I don't think he's ever even smoked cannabis. You know.
Funny actually, on the there was a part in the book where he kind of differentiated between like cannabis and hash and the harder drugs, like the more kind of degenerative drugs. He compared, in my opinion, rightly, he compared like marijuana and hash to like beer, you know, alcohol. I don't know if he expressed any opinions about like drug legalization, but he definitely drew a line between like someone who imports and sells weed and someone who goes higher and does cocaine and heroin and the like.
Yeah, he's against cocaine. He doesn't like what it does to people, he told me. But he's out in Torrevieja, and Torrevieja is full of cocaine. It's on every street corner up there. But he also believes that marijuana should be legalized.
Interesting.
But then he says that the only people that won't like drugs being legalized are the drug dealers themselves because they'll be out of business, he says.
Right, yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's funny, like in America here where I am, it used to be a big criminal enterprise selling alcohol, but now it's all there's no like illegal alcohol sellers these days because it's legal.
Oh, sure. Well, I was in New York in May
Oh yeah,
and
cool.
bought a packet of gummy bears next door to an Irish bar. It was a cannabis shop.
Yeah, oh God, they're everywhere, but you can't move with them now. Like, that's funny. Okay, so he during his peak years, he must have avoided causing enough conflict to for there to be an assassination attempt on him. But coming out of prison, we mentioned the one where he was supposed to show up at, I think, the halfway house, but didn't, and probably would have been shot if he had. Then there was a very real attempt. He got six bullets pumped into him, and his life might have been saved by the fact that he played dead on the floor. It's kind of strongly rumored, I think, that it was the Kinahans, and Christy Kinahan being the head of that. He denies that strenuously, though, doesn't he?
Yeah, well, Gilligan won't tell me who shot him or why they shot him. He said that he made peace with the particular people involved, and you know they have an agreement not to talk about
Right.
it. So you just have to make your own conclusions of about who would want this done. I can't get an answer out of him for that from that.
Sure. No, I'd imagine he'd keep that one close.
Yeah.
What was I gonna say? Okay, did you get the sense after all this that you got like an overall honest interview from him? Like, if 10 out of 10. Like, if 100% is one th is fully honest, where would you put his average? Like,
Well, there's a lot of honesty in the book. Obviously, he's a convicted criminal. He is a he has lied under oath. He says it in the book that he has lied under oath. He has lied a lot under oath, and he has he can't take the he, how would I put how would I answer this? He comes across as very honest when I ask him questions about anything to do with himself personally, particularly in his formative years, about he confesses to a lot of crimes and talks about for example, beating up his ex-wife, assaulting his father because the father had, was beating up the mother and his sisters. So there's a lot of honesty in there in that. It's really down to the reader to read the book and make up their own mind. I purposely did the book as a Q&A because I didn't want to do it as a straightforward biography because people will want to read Gilligan in his own words. That's why the subheading of the book, I think, is Ireland's Most Notorious Criminal in His Own Words. So it's done in a Q&A format, but I allow it to flow, and I o occasionally, will put footnotes in the book to point out when he says something that is not actually true. I mean, for example, in one part of the book, he says, Dutchie Holland was a lovely man. He never hurt anybody. And then I point that out later in the interviews. He told me that Dutchie Holland was a hitman. Because
Who never hurt anyone, yeah.
yeah, so how could he go from not hurting anyone to being a hitman? And Gilligan told me he only told me Dutchie was a hitman in the end after many, many days in his company, simply because he said he wanted to tell me as much truth as possible. He said, "I don't want to lie to you about anything." So and sometimes I'd get a no comment from him. Like apparently he would use a gun and point to lorry drivers' heads when stealing the consignment of cigarettes and stuff like that. And he just said to me, "No comment on that." So I think he's done his best. He's put his best foot forward, and he's done his best to tell as much about his life as possible. His motives for this is like he's 71 years of age, and he really doesn't have that many years left. So this is, I believe this book will be in the future an important document for future historians and criminologists, because this will be one of the primary sources they'll be able to look back on when they're writing about gangland crime in the latter stages of the 20th century in Ireland, because Gilligan speaks at length in it. And it's even though it's done as a Q&A, I let him speak at length in a way that he's a very good storyteller. So he starts act when in his presence, he would start acting out the other characters like the general or trainer or main. So there's a lot of it flows quite well. There's a lot of dialogue in the book, because it almost sometimes reads like it's in first person, as it.
Right. I was going to say that there was no stage of the book where there was any kind of drag or anything. Like it all flowed really well. And like you said, yeah, because it was done Q&A, yeah, you're getting the kind of a first person view on it.
Yeah, and I think don't want to spoil it for the reader. Leave it to them to make up their own minds. The readers aren't stupid. They're going to know if he's lying, if he's telling the truth.
Did you get a sense that there was any maybe ulterior motive for him wanting to do this interview? This I think he presented it as being like a finally a chance to get his own story out and correct like media allegations and so on. But did you get the sense there was anything else behind it? There was like particular talking points he wanted to get out about people or something.
Oh yeah. He really wanted to set the record straight on his version of the story when it came to the assault on Fonnachie Gearan to Cab, because he gets angry when people say Cab was started because of him. Where,
Right.
in the documentary, Felix McKenna, who was one of the first one of the heads that the head of Cab, said, well, the emergency legislation only came in because of the murder of Fonnachie Gearan. He says that in the documentary. So that angers him, and he wanted to get his side out about that. Also, the phone call that he allegedly made to Fonnachie about sodomizing her son. These were things, hot potato issues, so to speak, that he really wanted to get his point of view across on. And then there was other motives where he wanted to take pot shots at some of his former colleagues like Brian Meehan. I mean, in the last chapter, he talks about the week he was getting out of prison and Brian Meehan coming to visit him, and Brian Meehan said to him, "Perhaps we could start working together doing drugs when you're on the outside." And Gilligan went ballistic and started shouting at him in his cell, saying that was all his fault. It was down to him that Gilligan lost everything. So I do think he there was a few people there that he wanted to lash in the text, lash out in the text, like John Traynor, and even though he's dead, and Brian Meehan in particular,
Right, yeah,
and Charlie Bowden.
I see. Yeah, I did get that sense off. I'll let you go there soon enough. Towards the very end, very very end of the book, he mentions, that he feels like he's going to hell. He does like he says that, I don't know. I don't know how like religious he really is. I don't think I heard any kind of allusions to like a religious life or you know a religious thinking throughout his life. But he did say that he feels like he's going to hell. Again, did that seem genuine to you or to me? I mean, I think a lot of things could be interpreted as like him just trying to seem more like relatable and humble, where he might not really be like.
Well, I think by saying I'm going to hell, it makes him out to be a monster in some ways, because only really bad people go to hell. Gilligan, he's not religious. He always says God bless you at the end of a phone conversation, but I think that's just an instinctive thing
An
drummed
Irish
into him. Yeah, an instinctive Irish thing, you know, from particularly from his generation. But he's not very religious. But he does say if there is a God, then I'm going to hell. If there, you know, if there is a heaven and hell, I'll definitely go to hell. So he knows he's done a lot of bad things in his life.
Oh yeah, okay, so there's a lot of words that get thrown out a lot. When you're talking about like you know like criminals and kind of underworld figures or you know when people watch interviews about them and what one of those words is narcissist, people you know you know it's in kind of an intelligent sounding way of saying like someone who's like self-obsessed and have a huge ego, also psychopath, not a psycho like crazy, but someone who like lacks empathy and that would help in the world he operated in. Did any of those did either of those two words apply to him in your mind ever?
Which two words? Sorry.
Sorry, like a narcissist or like a psychopath, someone lacking empathy.
Oh, right. Well, you'll be the first person I'll tell this to. He rang me the other day and he's talking to me and he says, "Jason, tell me honestly, do you think I'm a psychopath?"
Boy.
Because that word is being thrown around in a lot of articles and radio shows recently. Everybody's calling him a narcissist and a psychopath. The Gilligan I know now, the Gilligan I've met is an OAP, and I wouldn't see him as a psychopath. I haven't met Gilligan in his formative years. I've only heard all the horror stories, and if you're going on the horror stories, only a psychopath could carry out those type of crimes and horrible deeds. But he maintains that, you know, there's this image of him that's being blown out of all proportion. And I can only go on the man I've met now, and he's not a psychopath. Huge ego, yeah. He does love himself, but a lot of people do, but him more than others, I'd say. But I've you know when it when I found them easy to get on with when you're not on the hard subjects,
Okay.
but when you're on the hard subjects, you have to watch your step, you know, because he becomes extremely passionate and can get very agitated, and you can see the Robert De Niro style character coming out. You know, he does remind me, he's a mixture of Martin Cattell meets Robert De Niro in Heat. That's how I best describe
But he's actually he mentioned he's quite a fan of that movie too, and De Niro's character.
it. Yeah, I could see a lot of similarities. I'd say Gilligan was really like that when he was younger. Would you see De Niro in Heat as a psychopath?
I wouldn't. No, I wouldn't call him a psychopath. He's definitely someone who can, on a professional basis, he can like I think he can flick a switch and turn off the empathy and turn off any kind of sympathy and do it for a job. But I don't know. I don't know if that actually kind of makes you a psychopath if you can just flick it on and off. But no, I wouldn't. If I had to say yes or no, I wouldn't say De Niro's character in Heat would be like what I think of as a psychopath.
Yeah, so I would see him as De Niro in Heat, you know, myself. So we probably have answered that question there in a roundabout way.
Right.
But you know, he's an OAP now, and he says he feels like he's a man in his 40s, you know.
Right.
Feels young, but he does know he's only got a few years left in him. I mean, he still has bullets in him that
Right.
they couldn't get.
He said he was in a prison at one stage, and he tried taking one out himself, right?
He did take one out himself. He cut open a razor blade in prison in Belfast, and used that to slice open the side of his stomach, and put his hand in and pulled it out because it was starting to hurt. It was extremely painful for him, and it was starting to come out. So he opened himself up and took it out with his hands,
Jesus.
and hid the bullet, by the way. So the authorities in Belfast couldn't get it because he didn't want to expose who the killer was.
Ah, okay, so you could trace it. Wow, Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
I'm committed to saving a shooter. You mentioned there that he phoned you up and asked the he asked you a very very candid question. He asked like, did he come across as a psychopath too? If you don't mind sharing, what did you tell him?
I said no. It was basically the same discussion we just had there about, he's an OAP, and the man in front of me is not a psychopath. And I got the impression that he was like De Niro when he was younger in Heat.
Interesting.
He only asked because that day was all over the papers and all over the radio. So he's asking me, what do you think about this?
Okay.
I just said it to him. I was surprised he rang me up and asked me, So obviously it was playing on his mind.
Given that he does like call you up on occasion and chat or complain about something someone said on a radio show, do you get the sense that he that he's maybe like in a place in his life where he kind of wants someone to talk to, or that he may be lacking that.
Yeah, I think he trusts me because I spent a year and a half working on this project and none of it was leaked. I managed to keep it secret.
Right.
And none of what he told me off the record, some of it is sensational stuff, is not in the book. And I haven't leaked anything to the press during the 18 months. I mean, it was amazing that he didn't tell anybody, didn't even tell his partner he was doing interviews with me. I didn't really tell many people either because I didn't want to get leaked. I want the element of surprise.
Course.
So when the doc and the book came out, people would go, wow. And there's even an audio book coming out later in September.
Right.
WF House, the biggest audio book supplier, publisher in the UK, are bringing that out. So yeah, it's he trusts me because he knows I'm not a blabbermouth in that sense. Even though I am by doing the book, but
Yeah, I get you. Thanks again for all the time. I appreciate you going into the behind the scenes and the insight into this book. Like you said, you didn't say it this way, but I think, in my opinion, like I've read a lot of kind of crime books and Irish gangland and stuff. This one is, in my opinion, kind of head and shoulders above most. And I think, like you said, I think it'll later be like a primary source for those wishing to study that time in Irish crime,
That's very kind of you to say, John, that you think it's head and shoulders above the other books. But it's just, I think it's because it's Gilligan speaking and it's the style it's done in. It's just an unusual book because we have never seen a book like this published in Ireland before on an Irish criminal speaking at length so candidly.
Right.
I just got lucky with it. But sometimes you make your own luck to say, but I don't believe that. I just think I got really lucky with it. And I was just, if I think it's just being this week that it was launched, it was the perfect storm for it. Everything just came together. It was announced last Thursday, and then on Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, the Star and the Mirror serialized it, and that snowballed with other papers and radio stations following up on it. And then on Monday, we had Gilligan in court and being dramatically found, not guilty. And then Monday night, the documentary is screened. And it was actually, I was told this morning by my producer, the highest rating show for the 10 p.m. slot in the entire year on any TV station in Ireland.
Jesus, nice.
Figures are phenomenal for it. So it's just a perfect storm in that sense. I just got lucky. You couldn't plan something like this. I didn't know until recently that his court case was going to be on Monday, because it kept getting postponed all the time. It was meant to be in August, it was meant to be earlier in the year. Then I heard it might be at Christmas, so it just happened that potluck. Monday he's in court, and the TV show comes out and the book comes out on Monday too. On Monday, the book by 12 o'clock that same day on Monday, Amazon had sold out of the
Great.
book. Amazon had no copies left; they were out of stock.
Oh yeah. Actually, last night I watched the first episode of the documentary. And I was reading the book like in the same days that they're actually they're a great companion together, because there was even parts of the book, like exact quotes that I remembered reading, but then seeing the man say it and speak it, and the way he talked, and you just get a lot better sense. When you have both, they're a great companion to each other. Like,
And one thing about the book, I actually feel the book is better than the documentary in some ways, because with the documentary, there's a lot of other talking heads explaining stuff. So you don't get, it's not Gilligan throughout the entire documentary talking, but in the book, it's Gilligan talking at length. And I had to bite my tongue a lot of the time not to interrupt them, and to allow a flow to go and not a stop start. Style, because if you keep interrupting them, it's not going to flow. And I love the Paul Reynolds. I think he's one of the best crime writers, journalists in Ireland, and for the RTÉ. But he went the opposite direction with his interview with the monk. Kept butting in with the monk, and the monk went on the defense then on the back foot and didn't come out of his shell. And the idea with this was, you see. I suppose if I was only doing one interview with Gilligan, he'd go on the attack. But I knew I was going to spend a lot of time in his company, and I wanted him to come out of his shell. So a bit like how they did the Jimmy Savile documentary, where the Turow allowed him to come out of his cell when he was, because he spent a lot of time with him. So I that was my game plan with this book: just let him open up bit by bit to get as much of a good picture of the guy as possible. And the other thing was, I have to say before we go, I was surprised to see three government senior ministers attack the documentary and the book before it had even come out.
Who were they?
The Minister for Justice, the Minister for Drugs, and Simon Harris. So I was going to say I was really surprised that they criticized it before even seeing it. I kind of felt like I was trapped in an episode of Father Ted with him saying, "Down with this sort of thing" mantra, you know? I was wondering, did he even believe in free speech? The same ministers weren't up in arms when Malcolm MacArthur conducted interviews for a book earlier this year by Mark O'Connell, which I read in August, A Thread of Violence. And I have to say, it's a brilliant book. But I think it would be good to have a minister for justice and a minister for drugs that would be smart enough to watch a documentary on one of Ireland's biggest drug barons. They're both utterly losing their wars. The first principle of a war is to know your enemy. Their actions and attitudes go a long way towards explaining why. And a minister for justice and a minister for drugs should be embarrassed not to be watching a portrait of crime. That to me is, it's almost like a sense, a form of censorship, where they're saying, you shouldn't watch this documentary. And they were saying that the producers should consider why they've made this documentary, basically suggesting that it shouldn't go ahead. But I mean, a lot of se just a several seen se several members of the, several senior guards who participated in this documentary, and they were all very happy with it, I've been told. Felix McKenna and the former assistant Garda Commissioner Michael O'Sullivan are both in it, so I don't think they would have participated if they felt it was going to be a type of documentary to glorify crime or Gilligan himself.
You mentioned there about Paul Reynolds took a very, very kind of combative sort of interview with Jerry Hutch. In my opinion, I mean, look, he's experienced and all that. I wouldn't try to tell him what to do, but in my opinion, like as a journalist or even as like a podcast interviewer, I don't really think it's your job to have like to kind of call them out and have like a big and have like a big argument with them. I think it's more like you should ask tough questions and all, but it's more about like like presenting information as opposed to like butting heads because this person's a bad person, you know?
Yeah, maybe I would have went that route, as I said, if I had only one interview an hour. Normally, when I did the hot press interviews, I'd probably be gentle, gentle, and then eventually combative, as you put it, for the last 10 or 15 minutes, you know? But I had a unique privilege, I suppose, with this project that I had so many hours and days with Gilligan that I could just allow him to open up naturally. And it's a type of thing where you give them enough rope to do the job themselves, you know?
Yeah, I get what you mean. Just one final thing, but before I leave you go, this was a great between the documentary and the book. It was really like an excellent project. If you were to get, if you were to get a call from maybe some other infamous, kind of gangland type who maybe you hadn't had a relationship with, however sporadically, like you had with Gilligan. Like if another criminal came to you and said, "Look, I want to do this." Just, big long hours of interview and a book and in my own words. Would that be something you'd be interested in general?
I don't know. It would depend on the subject. It's they're long projects. They're quite stressful.
Right.
And I don't know if I want to be pigeonholed as a journalist that writes books and makes docs on criminals either. I just made a documentary out in LA about the Catholic Church is my second one. Funnily enough, it's based on Monsignor Hawks, who Robert De Niro played in True Confessions. It's based, it's so I just wrapped that, and we're in the process of editing it, and I got the money to from the producers to make that on over in the States, based on the fact that I'd made the Gilligan project without even seeing it. I just said to them, I've made a 3-hour documentary on Gilligan, and they said, okay, how much do you need? And that was it. They just gave me the money.
Interesting. Okay. Yeah, we might speak again when that comes out, and it's like for public release. It does sound very interesting.
But yeah, I wouldn't rule out doing another documentary on a criminal. It would really depend on which one, who it was.
I see. I see. If there were I mean, God, I don't know if like Christy Kinahan, say, came to you, would do you think you'd be interested?
Or the monk.
Right, yeah, I'm sure he's a fascinating story to tell you.
Yeah, but there's not that many other criminals that are high profile enough in Ireland, I feel, at this moment in time.
Yeah, and still alive, I suppose. There's probably been, I don't know, I don't know if there's been fellas as big as quite as big as Gilligan, but plenty of Irish drug lords meet a similar end, which is usually getting assassinated by someone in their own team who wants to take over.
I mean, there is the Penguin, but I don't know if that would have the appeal that Gilligan had, you know? People probably even forget who the Penguin was, you know, but he's still alive and kicking over in Holland, I think. But I just don't think that would work. You wouldn't it, I don't think it'd be as successful. I would have done one, I suppose, on Dutchie Holland if he's still been alive. I'd interviewed him in London, and I found him a fascinating character. He used to ring me every Sunday for a while from prison.
Really?
He got his phone calls on Sundays, because he just had nobody else really to call. He didn't have that much family.
I see.
He had a family, but in Dublin, but not much, you know.
Right, I
A
got,
few.
yeah. He might have wanted like a fresh set of ears to talk into. Again, thank you so much for if even for even for writing the book. It was a fascinating insight into, I forgot to mention this, but I think I'm fairly sure, like when I was in my early teens, this was he was the very first kind of crime or gangland figure that I became aware of. I think I was in the library, and I think I saw like Evil Empire by Paul Williams, and that was my first that was my first kind of look into like Irish crime, and it became a bit of an interest for me, you know.
Yeah. No, that's, I remember reading that book, Paul's book, and I think that was a big hit in the States. He's obviously the leading crime writer in Ireland. He's dedicated his life to writing about crime, and I think he's the biggest selling crime author in Ireland of all time, which speaks for itself. He was on a podcast and a radio show yesterday, and it really took me aback. He was very generous. He congratulated me on getting the scoop of the Gilligan interviews, so that was very nice of him.
Very good. Thank you very much again, though, for all your time. Had a great time speaking to you. And for anyone who hasn't, for anyone who hasn't read the book or watched the documentary, I'd highly recommend both. I'll put the link for the book in the podcast and the YouTube description there.
Thanks for having me on the show, John. I really enjoyed talking to you. Your questions were great.
Well, thank you, from an interviewer, that means.